The Psycho-Socio-Sexual Awakening of Little Olivia. So much more education than she signed on for when she came to town. She arrived on campus 3 years before, with a teddy bear, a hairdryer, a hot air popper, and a high school varsity letter in volleyball. She means to leave next spring with a crater-strewn transcript, 2 tongue studs, a florid tattoo on her scapula, and a scrapbook of mental travels she could never have imagined. She's still a good girl, of sorts. The plan is simply to be a semi-bad girl for a few more months. Then she'll straighten up, fly right, and head westerly, where all good fuck-ups always head. Once out there, wherever there is, there'll be plenty of time to figure out how to salvage her bungled degree. She can be ingenious when required, and she knows how to make herself more than cute with a little application. Things are happening. The world is cracking open. She might check out Berlin now that the future is headed that way. Vilnius, Warsaw, someplace where the rules are being hammered out from scratch. The music pelts her deltoids and takes her brain out for a lazy adult swim. Spiders set up a colony under her skin. When she places a palm on her thigh, the push of it keeps gliding all the way out to the idea horizon. Soon the beautiful brainstorms come, the ones that link up in front of her eyes and make the whole mess of human history so lovely and self-evident. The universe is big, and she's allowed to fly around through the nearby galaxies for a while, zapping things for fun, if she doesn't abuse her powers or hurt anyone. She does so love this ride. Then the tunes start up, the inner ones. She shuts off the disc player and tries to figure out how to cross the ocean of room. When she stands, her head keeps rising, straight up, into a whole new layer of being. Her laugh propels her, helps her balance, and she sails off across the floorboards, her tits glowing like precious pearls. After a while, she gets to where she was going and holds still for a minute, trying to recall why she needed to get there. Hard to hear anything over the magic melodies of her own devising. She sits at her chipboard student desk and fishes out her song notebook. Real musical notation reads to her like so much secret writing, but she has devised her own system for preserving the tunes that come to her while stepping out. Line color, thickness, and location all encode a record of the gift melodies. And the next day, after her buzz wears off, she can look at these scribbles and hear the music all over again. Like copping a contact buzz for free. Tonight's tune pushes her back into the chair as a band of unknown instruments play the song the angels will play for God on the night he decides to bring everybody home. It's the best inner soundtrack she has ever managed, perhaps the best thing she's done with her entire life. She starts crying and wants to call her parents. She wants to go back down into the rooming house and embrace her housemates, this time for real. The music says, "You don't know how brilliantly you shine." It says, "Something is waiting for you, the clean, perfect thing you've wanted since childhood." Then that hallowed bliss turns ridiculous, and she laughs, a little wildly, at her own wasted soul. But the tune and the bliss leave her tingling all over. The idea of a hot shower takes on religious urgency. Her rigged-up bathroom, carved out of the same attic as her bedroom, sports a skin of frost on the inside of its north wall. The secret is to run the hot water before disrobing. By the time she gets into the do-it-yourself shower, she's faint from hunger, and the bathroom air is a paisley swirl of fire and ice. She looks down. The floor of the stall fills with bloody lather. She screams. Then she remembers her sliced ankle. As she soaps the oozing wound, the giggles come again, Humans are so frail. How have they survived long enough to wreak all the shit they have? The cleaning stings like hell. The gash is jagged and ugly. If it scars, she can hide it with another tattoo, some kind of ankle chain, perhaps. She works the soap up her legs. The slickness of her skin feels like the best divorce present a girl could ask for. Each touch is electric. Her body brightens, demanding satisfaction. Someone knocks hard. You okay in there? Her voice takes a moment to catch. Go away, please. You screamed. Scream over. Thank you. She materializes back in her room. Her body, draped in towel and steam, shines with need. Even the gelid air strokes her like a sex toy. The world offers nothing better than bringing yourself over the crest of ecstasy. She drops the towel and splays into bed. The fall into the blankets lasts forever and keeps improving. She reaches up into the shade of the floor lamp to shut it off and plunge herself into delicious darkness. But as her damp hand pats for the switch on the cheap socket, all the current in the subcode house enters her limb and pours into her body. Her muscles close around the jolt as in some science experiment, clamping her hand around the electricity that's killing her. She lies there, naked, wet, convulsing, her hands snaked up in the air, trying to force the word help from the bottom of her lungs out through a mouth that the voltage locks rigid. She manages to birth up one ambiguous moan before her heart stops. Down below, her housemates hear the cry, her second of the night. The sound's raw intimacy makes them blush. Olivia, one says, smirking. Don't even ask. The whole house dims the moment she dies. Trunk. A man sits at a desk in his cell in a medium-security prison. Trees have landed him here. Trees and too much love of them. He still can't say how wrong he was, or whether he'd choose to be so wrong again. The only text that can answer that question spreads, unreadable, under his hands. His fingers trace the grain in the desk's wooden top. He's trying to see how these wild loops in the wood could ever have come from so simple a thing as rings. Some mystery in the angle of the cut, the place of the plane inside the nested cylinders. If his brain were a slightly different thing, the problem might be easy. If he himself grew differently, he might be able to see. The grain under his fingers swings in uneven bands. Thick light, thin dark. It shocks him to realize, after a lifetime of looking at wood, he's staring at the seasons, the year's pendulum, the burst of spring and the enfolding of fall, the beat of a 2-4 song recorded here, in a medium that the piece itself created. The grain wanders like ridges and ravines on a topo map. Pale rush forward, darker holding back. For a moment the rings resolve from out of the angled cut. He can map them, project their histories into the wood's plane. And still, he's illiterate. Wide in the good years, sure, and narrow in the bad, but nothing more. If he could read, if he could translate, if he were only a slightly different creature, then he might learn all about how the sun shone and the rain fell and which way the wind blew against this trunk for how hard and long. He might decode the vast projects that the soil organized, the murderous freezes, the suffering and struggle, shortfalls and surpluses, the attacks repelled, the years of luxury, the storms outlived, the sum of all the threats and chances that came from every direction in every season this tree ever lived. His finger moves across the prison desk, trying to learn this alien script, transcribing it like a monk in a scriptorium. He traces the grain and thinks of all the things this antique, illegible almanac could say, all the things that the remembering wood might tell him in this place where he is held, with no change of seasons and one fixed weather. She's dead, for a minute and 10 seconds. No pulse, no breath. Then Olivia's body, shucked from the lamp when the fuses blow, spills over the edge of the bed and hits the floor. The impact restarts her stopped heart. Naked and comatose on the pine floorboards. That's how Olivia's new ex-husband finds her when he comes over in hope of a major blowout, followed by makeup sex. He rushes her to the university hospital, where she revives. She's still buzzed. Her ribs are bruised, her hand burned, and her ankle lacerated. The physician's assistant wants a full account, which Olivia can't give. The feckless, distraught ex-husband leaves her in doctor's hands. The doctors want to do some neurological assessment. They want a scan. But Olivia escapes when no one's looking. It's a university hospital, and everyone's busy. She strolls out through the lobby, the picture of health. Who's to stop her? She heads back to the boarding house and barricades herself in her room. Her housemates ascend to the attic to check on her, but she refuses to open the door. For 2 full days, she hides in her room. Each time anyone knocks, the voice inside calls out, "I'm fine!" Her housemates don't know who to call. No sounds come from behind the door, except for muffled shuffling. Olivia sleeps and keeps still, holds her bruised ribs, and tries to remember what happened. She was dead. In those seconds while she had no pulse, large, powerful, but desperate shapes beckoned to her. They showed her something, pleading with her. But the moment she came back to life, everything vanished. She finds her song notebook wedged behind the desk. Colored jottings recreate the tune in her head just before her electrocution. Through the tune, she retrieves much of the evening's disaster. She sees herself parading around the renovated attic, addicted to her body. It's like watching a zoo animal circle its cage. For the first time, she realizes that being alone is a contradiction in terms. Even in a body's most private moments, something else joins in. Someone spoke to her when she was dead, used her head as a screen for disembodied thoughts. She passed through a triangular tunnel of strobing color and emerged into a clearing. There, the presences, the only thing to call them, removed her blinders and let her look through. Then she fell back into her prison body, and the incredible vistas blurred to nothing. She thinks, "Maybe I have brain damage." Several times an hour she must shut her eyes while words move her speechless lips. "Tell me what happened. What am I supposed to do now?" It takes a while before she realizes she's praying. She skips all her finals, calls her parents to say she won't be flying home for Christmas. Her father is baffled, then hurt. Ordinarily, she'd resort to outshouting the man, but nobody's anger can hurt a girl who has already died. She tells him everything, her solo divorce party, her electrocution. Hiding is pointless now. Something's watching. Huge, living sentinels know who she is. Her father sounds lost, the way she feels when she lies in bed at night, sure she'll never retrieve what was shown to her while she was dead. Now, post-mortem, she hears her father's fear. Dark undercurrents in the lawyer she never suspected. For the first time since she was a child, she wants to comfort him. "Daddy, I screwed up. I hit the wall. I need to rest."
"Come home. You can rest here. You can't be alone at the holidays."
He sounds so frail. He has always been alien to her, a man of procedures, where there should be passions. Now, she wonders if he might have died once, too. They talk for longer than they have in years. She tells him what dying feels like. She even tries to tell him about the presences in the clearing, the ones that showed her things, though she uses words that won't freak him. Impulses, energy. Twice he's on the verge of hopping in the car and driving the 650 miles to bring her back home. She talks him down. 70 seconds of death have invested her with strange power. Everything between them has altered, as if he's the child now and she the guardian. She asks for something she has never asked for before. "Put Mom on for a minute. I want to talk to her." Even her mother's fury is Olivia's now to know and soothe. By the end of their conversation, both women are in tears, promising each other crazy things. She's alone in the boarding house from Christmas until New Year's. Every intoxicant she owns goes down the toilet. Her grades arrive, 2 Fs, a D-minus, and a C. The letters are a distraction from that thing she's fighting to remember. Whole days pass when she barely eats. An ice storm coats the town in a lapidary crust. It tears boughs off the oaks and maples. Olivia sits on the bed where her heart stopped, her knees to her chest, and her song notebook in her lap. She stands and steps. The spot on the floor where Davy found her that night feels hot under her bare feet. She's alive, and she doesn't know why. She lies awake at night, staring upward, remembering being right next to the only discovery that matters. Life was whispering instructions to her, and she failed to write them down. The prayer thing becomes easier. "I'm still. I'm listening. What do you want from me?" On New Year's Eve, she's asleep by 10. 2 hours later, she wakens to gunfire and bolts up, screaming. Then the clock tells her, fireworks. The 90s have arrived. Her housemates return in the new year. They treat her like she's ill. They're afraid of her, now that her bitchiness has vanished. She sits in the kitchen while people around her joke and get smashed and try to ignore the ghost at the table. It amazes her that she has never felt their sadness or noticed their distress. Incredibly, they still believe in safety. They live as if a shim and some duct tape might hold them together. They have become vulnerable in her eyes, and infinitely dear. On the first day of the new semester, Olivia sits on the rim of an auditorium bowl, while a brilliant lecturer calculates the premiums and payout needed for both the insurance company and the dead person to feel that they've won. "Insurance," the lecturer says, "is the backbone of civilization. No risk pool, no skyscrapers, no blockbuster movies, no large-scale agriculture, no organized medicine." The empty seat next to her rustles. She turns. There, inches from her face, is the thing she's been praying for. A cone of charged air gusts into her thoughts. They've returned, beckoning. They want her to stand and leave the auditorium. She will do whatever they ask. Down the stone steps in her winter coat, she crosses the icy main quad. She skirts the classroom buildings, the library, a freshman dorm, walking without thinking, drawn along by the presences. For a moment, she imagines her destination is the Civil War Cemetery south of campus. Then it's clear she's heading toward the parking lot where she keeps her car. Inside the car, she understands that she'll be driving for a while. She stops at the boarding house to fetch some things. 3 trips to her room suffice to salvage everything she could want. She piles the clothes on the back seat. Then she's gone. The car finds its way to the state highway. Soon she's passing the sedge meadows and oak openings northwest of town. Last fall's stubble dots the snow-covered fields. She drives for a long time, obeying the presences. Like a radio station from another city, their signal wavers between clear and static. She makes herself an instrument of their will. Across the Maumee, the way jogs southwest. A breakfast bar in the glove compartment passes for lunch. Her change purse holds several bills and a debit card for an account containing just under $2,000. Her mind has nothing even faintly resembling a plan, but she remembers what Jesus said about the flowers and not worrying about tomorrow. Once the nuns made every student memorize a Bible passage. She chose that one to irritate the teacher, who was big on personal responsibility. She liked the Jesus who would appall every law-abiding, property-acquiring American Christian. Jesus the communist, the crazed shop-trasher, the friend of deadbeats. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. A gust of remorse passes through her as she drives. I'm missing statistical inference. Fitting. To this point in life, she has missed everything. Now, inference vanishes, and soon she'll know. Dusk and Indiana come faster than she expects. Darkness, ridiculously early, still so close to the solstice. She's starved for real food and so tired she keeps hitting the snow-drifted rumble strip. The presences vanish for half an hour. Her confidence slips. It's hard to pray and drive at the same time. In front of her spread the vacant cornfields of the true Midwest. She has no idea why she's here. Then something occupies the passenger seat, and she's good for another 100 miles. Davy once told her that the best place to sleep rough is outside a warehouse store. She finds one easily and pulls the car into a well-lit corner of the plowed lot under the security camera. A quick duck inside to pee and buy snacks, and she returns to the car to set up camp in the back seat. She falls asleep under 3 armloads of clothes, praying, waiting, listening. It's Indiana, 1990. Here, 5 years is a generation, 50 is archaeology, and anything older shades off into legend. And yet, places remember what people forget. The parking lot she sleeps in was once an orchard, its trees planted by a gentle, crazed Swedenborgian who wandered through these parts in rags and a tin pot cap, preaching the new heaven and extinguishing campfires to keep from killing bugs. A crackpot saint who practiced abstinence while supplying 4 states with enough fermentable apple mash to keep every pioneer American from 9 to 90 half-crocked for decades. All day long, she has followed Johnny Appleseed's path into the interior. Olivia read about the man once, in a comic her father gave her. The comic made him a superhero, with the power to make things spring up from the dirt. It said nothing about the philanthropist with a shrewd sense of property, the tramp who'd die owning 1,200 acres of the richest land in the country. She always thought he was just a myth. She must still discover that myths are basic truths twisted into mnemonics, instructions posted from the past, memories waiting to become predictions. Here's the thing about an apple. It sticks in the throat. It's a package deal. Lust and understanding. Immortality and death. Sweet pulp with cyanide seeds. It's a bang on the head that births up whole sciences. A golden delicious discord. The kind of gift chucked into a wedding feast that leads to endless war. It's the fruit that keeps the gods alive. The first, worst crime, but a fortunate windfall. Blessed be the time that apple taken was. And here's the thing about an apple's seeds. They're unpredictable. Offspring might be anything. Staid parents generate a wild child. Sweet can go sour, or bitter turn buttery. The only way to preserve a variety's taste is to graft a cutting onto new rootstock. It would surprise Olivia Vandergriff to learn every apple with a name goes back to the same tree. Jonathan, Macintosh, Empire, lucky rolls in Malus's Monte Carlo game. And a named apple is a patentable apple, as Olivia's father would tell her. She once fought with him over a case of his. He was helping a transnational company prosecute a farmer who'd saved some of last year's soybean crop and replanted without paying royalties again. She was outraged. You can't own the rights to a living thing. You can. You should. Protecting intellectual property creates wealth. What about the soybean? Who's paying the soybean for its intellectual property? He looked at her with that judging frown. Whose child are you? The man who once owned the lot she sleeps in, the wandering apple missionary in the stovepot hat, was sure that grafting caused a tree pain. He'd pick apple seeds out of the pumice of a mill and sow an orchard with them a little farther west. And whatever seeds he sowed ran their own willful and unpredictable experiments. Like arcane magic, the man's waving hand transformed a swath from Pennsylvania to Illinois into fruit trees. All day long she drove that country. She sleeps now in a parking lot that was once an orchard full of unpredictable apples. The trees have vanished, and the town forgets, but not the land. She wakes early, stiff with cold, under a pile of clothing. The car is filled with beings of light. They're everywhere. Unbearable beauty, the way they were the night her heart stopped. They pass into and through her body. They don't scold her for forgetting the message they gave her. They simply infuse her again. Her joy at their return spills over, and she starts to cry. They speak no words out loud, nothing so crude as that. They aren't even they. They're part of her, kin in some way that isn't yet clear, emissaries of creation. Things she has seen and known in this world. Experiences lost, bits of knowledge ignored, family branches lopped off that she must recover and revive. Dying has given her new eyes. You were worthless, they hum, but now you're not. You have been spared from death to do a most important thing. What thing, she wants to ask, but she must keep silent and still. Life's moment is here, a test that it has not yet had. She lives through eternity under a pile of clothes in the back seat of a freezing car. Disembodied entities from the far side of death make themselves known, here, now, in the parking lot of this store, calling on her for help. The sun edges up out of the earth. Two shoppers exit the store. It's only dawn, and they're pushing a cart with a carton as large as her car. Her thoughts narrow to a point. Just tell me. Say what you want, and I'll do it. A container truck passes, grinding its gears on its way to the loading docks. In the noise, the beings disperse. Olivia panics. They haven't finished giving her the assignment. She scrambles in her shoulder bag for something to write with. On the back of a box of cough drops, she scribbles, "Spared. Test." But these words mean nothing. It's morning in earnest now. Her bladder is bursting. A minute more and nothing matters but peeing. She leaves the car and crosses the lot into the store. Inside, an older man greets her as if she's an old friend. The store is a drag show of well-being and mirth. Televisions line a wall at the back, ranging in size from breadbox to monolith. They're all tuned to the same morning diversion. Hundreds of skydivers join for a simultaneous mid-air church service. She plunges 50 yards through the gauntlet of screens into the bathroom. Relief, when it comes, is heavenly. Then sad again. "Just a sign," she pleads, drying herself. "Just say what you want of me." Back in the TV gauntlet, the mass aerial church service gives way to another gathering. All down the wall, on scores of different sets, people sit chained together in a trench in front of a bulldozer in a small town that the title text identifies as Solis, California. A quick cut, and a dozen people form a human ring around a tree they barely enclose. The tree looks like a special effect. The shot, even from a distance, encompasses only the bare base. Blue paint stains the behemoth trunk. A voiceover narrates the showdown, but the tree, replicated across a wall of screens, so stuns Olivia that she misses the details. The camera cuts away to a woman of 50 with pulled-back hair, a plaid shirt, and eyes like beacons. She says, "Some of these trees were around before Jesus was born. We've already taken 97% of the old ones. Couldn't we find a way to keep the last 3%? Olivia freezes. The creatures of light that ambushed her out in the car swarm her again, saying, "This, this, this." But the instant she knows she must pay strict attention, the segment ends and another begins. She stands, staring at a debate over whether flamethrowers are protected by the Second Amendment. The light beings vanish. Revelation collapses into consumer electronics. She wanders, dazed, out of the monster store. She's starving, but she buys nothing. She can't even imagine eating. In the car, she knows now that she must press on west. The sun rises behind her, filling her rearview mirror. Dawn-pinked snow coats the fields. Across the western sky, pewter clouds begin to lighten, and somewhere beneath them lies life's moment. She needs to call her parents, but she has no way to tell them what's happening. She drives another 50 miles, trying to reconstruct what she just saw. Plats of harvested Indiana farmland shine yellow-brown-black all the way to the horizon. The road is clear, and cars are few, with no towns to speak of. 2 days ago, down a road like this, she would have been doing 80. Today, she drives like her life might be worth something. Near the Illinois border, she crests a rise. Down the road, a railroad gate flashes. A long, slow, heartland freight rolls through on its way north to the superhub of Gary and Chicago. The steady ka-thump of the wheels through the intersection sets up a dub tune in her head. The train is endless. She settles in. Then she notices the cargo. Car after car clicks past, each loaded with pallets of dimensional lumber. A rolling river of wood, cut into uniform beams, streams by without end. She begins to count cars, but stops at 60. She has never seen so much wood. A map animates her head. Trains like this, this very minute, thread the country in every direction, feeding all the great metro sprawls and their satellites. She thinks, they have arranged this for me. Then she thinks, no, such trains pass by all the time. But now, she's primed to see. The last of the wood-stacked cars passes. The zebra guard lifts, and the red lights stop flashing. She doesn't move. Someone behind her honks. She holds still. The honker lays into the horn, then peels out around her, screaming in the sealed cabin and shaking a middle finger at her like he's trying to ignite it. She closes her eyes. Across her lids, small people sit chained together around an enormous tree. The most wondrous products of 4 billion years of life need help. She laughs and opens her eyes, which fill with tears. Confirmed. I hear you. Yes. She looks over her left shoulder to see a car pointed the other direction, stopped alongside her with the window down. An Asian man wearing a T-shirt that reads, Noli Timere, is asking her for the second time, Are you all right? She smiles and nods and waves apology. She starts her engine, which stalled while she was watching the endless river of lumber. Then she rolls out west again. Only now she knows where she's headed. Solace. The air all around sparks with connections. The presence is light around her, singing new songs. The world starts here. This is the merest beginning. Life can do anything. You have no idea. Years before, and far to the northwest, Ray Brinkman and Dorothy Cazale Brinkman head back home after midnight from the party following the St. Paul Players' opening night of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. They've just played the young couple, Nick and Honey, who, over a few drinks with new friends, learn what their species can do. Months ago, at the start of rehearsals, the four leads savored the play's viciousness. I'm nuts, Dorothy announces to the rest of the cast. I grant you that. But these people are truly gone. By opening night, all four of them are frayed and sick of each other and ready to do real damage. It makes for great community theater. The play is the Brinkman's best outing by far. Ray stuns everyone with his petty conniving. Dorothy is brilliant in that two-hour freefall from innocence into knowing. It takes only the slightest Stanislavski to find their inner demons. Next Friday is Dorothy's 42nd birthday. Over the course of several years, they've spent $150,000 on fertility treatments that turn out to be voodoo. 3 days before the play opened, they received the final blow. There's nothing left to try. My life, right? Dorothy is looped and weepy in the passenger seat, coming home from her triumph. All mine. I'm supposed to own it, right? It has become a sore spot between them. Ownership. What Ray spends all day safeguarding. He has never quite convinced his wife that prosecuting the theft of good ideas is the best way to make everyone richer. Drink does not help the level of debate. My own private personal property. Can I have a fucking garage sale? Dorothy's own job now makes her ill. People suing other people, and she must record every slanderous sentiment with her narrow, corded keyboard stenotype, word by precise word. All she wants is to have a child. A child would give her meaningful work at last. Barring that, She wants to sue someone. Ray makes an art of staying still under her attacks. He tells himself, not for the first time, that he has taken nothing away from her. If anything, he thinks, but he refuses to think that thought. That's his right, not to think what it's only fair to think. He doesn't have to. She has the thought for him. He clicks the clicker and the garage opens. They pull in.
"You should leave me," she says.
"Dorothy, please stop. You're making me crazy."
"Really? Leave. Go somewhere. Find somebody where you can have a family. Men do that forever. Guys can knock chicks up when they're 80, for fuck's sake. I wouldn't mind, Ray. Really? Only fair. You're the fairness guy, remember?" "Oop. He says nothing. Got nothing to say. Nothing to say in his defense."
Silence is what he has. His first and last best weapon. They come in the front door. "What a dump," they both think, though neither needs to say it. They drop their crap on the couch and head upstairs, where they take off their clothes, each in a separate walk-in closet. They stand at the his and hers sinks, brushing their teeth. The best night of acting they've ever done. A nice-sized theater full of enthusiastic applause. Calls for an encore. Dorothy puts one foot in front of the other, exaggerated, like the police, her husband, are making her walk a straight line. She raises her toothbrush to her mouth, waves it around, then breaks into tears, biting down on one end of the plastic stick while clutching the other. Ray, the night's designated driver, soberer than he cares to be, sets down his brush and goes to her. She leans her head on his collarbone. Toothpaste dribbles out of her mouth down his plaid bathrobe. Toothpaste and saliva everywhere. Her words are full of pebbles.
"I just want to stand in the lobby before the show and tell everyone as they come in, there's no fucking baby!"
He gets her to spit and wipes her off with a wash rag. Then he leads her to bed, a place that has felt much like a double-wide pine box these last 2 months. He must lift her feet in, then nudge her to make room. "We can go to Russia." It feels good to speak in his own voice, after way too many hours as someone smarmy. He doesn't want to play in any more plays ever again. Or China. So many babies that need parents who'll love them. There's a thing people in the theater call hanging the lampshade. Say there's a big ugly piece of pipe sticking out the backstage wall and you can't get rid of it. Stick a shade on it and call it a fixture. Her words blur into the damp pillow.
"Wouldn't be ours."
"Of course it would.
I want a little Ray Ray, your little guy, a boy, like how you were."
"It wouldn't be—"
"Or a little girl, like you, I don't care."
"Sweetie, don't be like this. A child is what you raise, not what genes you—"
"Genes are what you get, goddammit!"
She slaps the mattress and tries to bolt upright. The speed of the ascent tumbles her over.
"The only thing you truly own."
"We don't own our genes," he says, neglecting to add that companies can own them for us. "Listen, we go someplace where there are too many babies. We adopt two. We love them and play with them and teach them how to tell right from wrong, and they grow up all tangled together with us. I don't care whose genes they have." She pulls the pillow over her head.
"Listen to him. This guy can love everybody. Let's just get him a dog. Better yet, some vegetable we can stick out in the yard and forget about."
Then she remembers their anniversary custom, neglected for the past 2 years. She springs up to retrieve the words that fly out from her, but her shoulder clips him in the jaw just as he leans forward. His teeth mash up through the side of his tongue. He yells, then grabs his face, contorted with pain.
Oh, Ray! Shit! Damn me! I didn't mean...
He waves his hand in the air. I'm okay. Or, what's wrong with you? Or even, get away from me. She can't tell, even after a decade of marriage and other amateur theatricals, which. Out in the yard, all around the house, the things they've planted in years gone by are making significance, making meaning, as easily as they make sugar and wood from nothing, from air and sun and rain. But the humans hear nothing. Five interstates lead west. The fingers of a glove laid down on the continent with its wrist in Illinois. Olivia takes the middle one. She has a goal now. Northern California, by the fastest route, before the last trees as big as rocket ships go down. She crosses the Mississippi at the Quad Cities and stops at the world's largest truck stop on I-80 over the Iowa border. The place is a small town. She has her choice of more gas pumps than she can count before freezing. Several hundred trucks school around the spot where she pulls up. Colossal sharks in a feeding frenzy. The light is gone. Olivia rents a shower and gets herself human again. She strolls down a crowded, covered avenue of restaurants that offer hundreds of ways to partake of corn, corn syrup, corn-fed chicken, and corn-fed beef. There's a dentist's office and a masseuse, an enormous two-story showroom, a museum revealing how much of the world depends on trucks. There are game rooms and entertainment alleys, exhibits, lounges, and a fireplace flanked by stuffed chairs. She curls up in one and dozes off. She wakes to a security guard kicking her ankles.
No sleeping.
I was just sleeping.
No sleeping.
She returns to the car and dozes under her clothes again until dawn. Back in the food tunnel, she buys a muffin, changes $4 into quarters, finds a phone, and braces for the worst. But in her chest, a strange and newfound calm. The words will come. An operator tells her to deposit lots of money. Her father picks up.
Olivia, it's 6 in the morning. What's wrong?
Nothing. I'm fine. I'm in Iowa.
Iowa? What's going on?
Olivia smiles. What's going on is too big to fit into the phone.
Dad, it's all right. It's something good. Very good.
Olivia. Hello? Olivia?
I'm here.
Are you in trouble?
No, Dad, just the opposite.
Olivia, what on earth is happening?
I've made some new friends. Organizers. They have work for me.
What kind of work?
The most wondrous products of 4 billion years of life need help. It's simple enough and self-evident now that the light beings have pointed it out. Every reasonable person on the planet should be able to see. There's a project out west. Important volunteer work. I've been recruited.
What do you mean, recruited? What about your classes?
I won't be finishing school this term. That's why I called. I need to take some time off.
You what? Don't be ridiculous. You don't take time off 4 months before you graduate.
Generally true, although saints and soon-to-be billionaires have done exactly that.
You're just tired, Ollie. It's only a few weeks. It'll be over before you know it.
Olivia looks out on the motorists gathering in the court for breakfast.
Curious beyond saying, in one life
she dies of electrocution. In another, she's in the world's largest truck stop, explaining to her father that she's been chosen by beings of light to help preserve the most wondrous creatures on Earth. The voice on the other end of the phone turns desperate. Olivia can't help smiling. The life her father begs her to return to, the drugs, the unprotected sex, the psycho parties and life-threatening dares, is hell itself, while this trip westward is bringing her back from the dead.
You won't be able to get your rent back. It's too late for any kind of tuition refund. Just finish up, and you can do your volunteer work in the summer. I'm sure your mother...
In the background, Olivia's mother shouts, "I'm sure your mother what?" Olivia hears her mother yell something about paying for her own education. People mill around her. She feels their anxiety, the moving goal line of hunger. Her own life had been a haze of privilege, narcissism, and impossibly extended adolescence, filled with mean, sardonic hipness and self-protection. Now she has been called.
"Look," her father whispers into the phone, "be sensible. If you can't deal with one more semester right now, just come home."
More love courses through Olivia than she has felt since childhood. "Dad, thank you, but I need to do this."
"Do what? Where? Honey, are you still there? Sweetheart?"
"I'm here, Daddy."
Bits of the girl that she was only days ago tug at her, chanting, "Fight, fight." But the fight is real now, and elsewhere.
"Ollie, sit tight. I'll come get you. I can be out there by..."
Everything is so obvious, so blissfully clear, but her parents can't see it. There is great, joyous, and essential work to do, but first... a person needs to graduate from endless self-love.
"Daddy, I'm good. I'll call when I have more information."
A recorded woman cuts in, asking for another 75 cents. Olivia has no more change. All she has is a message spoken by the flashing-eyed woman on the wall of discount televisions and reworked by the light beings who dictate to her now as clearly as if they were on the other end of the phone. "The most wondrous things alive need you." Through the front glass doors of the truck stop, Olivia sees the dozens of gas pumps, and beyond them, the flat expanse of I-80 in the dawn, the snow-capped fields, the endless hostage swap of travelers east and west. Her father goes on talking, using all the persuasion techniques they teach you in law school. The sky does amazing things. It bruises a little in the freedom of the west, while to the east it spills open like a pomegranate. The phone clicks and goes dead. Olivia hangs up, a newly minted orphan. A thing reaching toward the sun, ready for anything. She leaves the truck stop, in love with aimless humanity. Back on the interstate, the sun rises again in her rearview mirror. Drumlins lift and fall. The road cuts a double trench through winter's white, all the way to the horizon. Attractions are few, but each one delights her. The Herbert Hoover Library and Museum. Sharpless Auction. A Manna Colonies. The interstate exits sound like characters in a novel about wayward, fey, southern aristocracy. Wilton Muscatine. Ladora Millersburg. Newton Monroe. Altoona Bondurant. Something comes over her, strange and beautiful courage. She has no resources, only a name for a destination, and no real clue about what she must do once there. Outside the car, it's bleak and arctic, and all her worldly possessions are back in her rooming house. yet she has a bank card linked to a small war chest, a sense of destiny that won't quit, and friends in what she can only assume are very high places. Hours pass like the rolling clouds. She's a ways down that flattening surveyor's line between Des Moines and Council Bluffs, with nothing in any direction except endless, frozen-over chaff, when something beckons from the side of her eye. She turns to see a phantom hitchhiker standing in the snow beyond the interstate's right shoulder. He waves more arms than Vishnu. One of them holds a banner she can't read. She pulls her foot off the gas and taps the brake. The hitchhiker turns into a tree, so big it could fill an entire car of that lumber death train back in Indiana. The fissured trunk corkscrews up for dozens of feet before fountaining into several hulking limbs. The tree stands back from the interstate, a column against the sky, the only thing taller than a farmhouse for miles around. Presences stir in the passenger seat. As she draws abreast of the tree, Olivia makes out words painted on the shingle hanging from one enormous branch. Free tree art. The presences run their twigs up the back of her neck. She pulls off at the next exit. Under the stop sign where the ramp meets a county highway, a hand-painted poster with the same vine-like lettering signals her to turn right. A second sign, half a country mile long, points her back toward the fabulous tree. Down the rolling road, Eden leaps out at her, a glade of broadleaf trees flowering as if it's May. It's like an opening in the side of this frozen, forgetting earth onto a hidden summer. 100 yards closer, the glade becomes the wall of an old barn, transformed by fabulous trompe-l'œil. She heads up the gravel drive into a pull-off alongside the barn and gets out. She stands staring at the mural. Even close up, the illusion knocks her out. "You're here about the sign?" She whirls. A man in jeans and a gray-white waffle shirt with hair like a Bronze Age prophet regards her. His breath steams. Bare hands clasp each opposite elbow. He's a few years older than she is, sad and wild, frightened to see a customer. The door of the farmhouse 20 feet behind him hangs open. The tree stands off alongside the house. It strikes Olivia that someone planted it here a very long time ago, simply to attract her attention. "Yes, I think I might be." She stands shivering, wanting her parka from the car. He studies her as if he means to flee. His chin rises and falls twice.
"Well, you're the first."
He points a long finger toward the painted barn, hand of a Renaissance crucifixion.
"Would you like to see the gallery?"
He leads her up a slight rise and ducks into the building. A flick of a switch reveals a space half homeless person's midden, half pharaonic tomb. Talismans everywhere. Totems, drawings, and cargo cult laid out on plywood planks spread across sawhorses. They look like the work of an autistic, Neolithic pantheist, unearthed by archaeology. Olivia swings her head, baffled. "You're giving these away?"
"It's not going to work, is it?"
"I don't understand." She wants to say, "This is crazy," but since she started hearing voices, the word has become less useful. It occurs to her to worry, here in the middle of nowhere, with a man who by any generous measure would count as strange. But a glance is enough to verify. The strangest thing about him is his innocence. And the art is real. She leans in toward a painting with a weird Gothic feel. Even in the dim barn light, the image is clear enough. A man lies in a narrow bed, staring down the tip of a tree branch that grows in through his window right up to his face. A green sticker on the panel